maintenant, nous allons passer à Sarah Skillen, que je vais vous présenter brièvement. Donc, Sarah a un parcours très intéressant. En 2011, elle a obtenu son master en histoire du design et de la culture matérielle à l'université de Brighton, au Royaume-Uni. Puis, elle a travaillé dans l'industrie de la mode à Londres pour les magazines Elle et Wallpaper, ainsi que pour les chapeliers Philip Tracy et Stephen Jones. À l'heure actuelle, elle effectue son doctorat au Center for Fashion Studies à l'Université de Stockholm en Suède. Donc, sa thèse de doctorat, Dior Without Dior, s'intéresse à la façon dont la maison Dior se réinvente après le décès du couturier original, à travers la succession charismatique d'une série de couturiers successifs, qui furent légitimés par le biais d'actes rituels tels que les défilés de mode, les cérémonies de remise de prix et des expositions muséales. Sa recherche examine la construction de la personnalité publique du couturier et sa dissémination à travers des sources visuelles, textuelles et audiovisuelles. L'héritage de Dior peut être vu comme une sorte de palimpseste où l'histoire de la maison est écrite, effacée et réécrite à chaque nouvelle ère, créant ainsi de multiples couches de souvenirs visuels et textuels qui renforcent les codes stylistiques de la maison. Donc ça, c'est la description de sa thèse de doctorat. Et aujourd'hui, donc, elle va nous parler de la construction de la personnalité publique de Marc Bohan tout au long de sa carrière chez Dior, de 1960 à 1989, avec un focus sur les années 84-89. Sa présentation s'intitule « J'aime vivre dans l'ombre », Marc Bohan à Dior, In the Age of the Designer. Merci, Sarah.
Thank you. Okay, so, thank you, Joanna. As she said, I'm going to talk about Marc Bohan at Dior during the 1980s. So, in the mid-1980s, Marc Bohan had been artistic director at the house for more than 25 years, since he took over from Yves Saint Laurent in 1960. In an interview with L'Officiel in 1986, Marc Bohan described how he preferred to live in the shadows. The context of this quote, which gave the title for this talk, described really his working process. It's not unusual for a designer or a curator to have this kind of working process, this frenzy of sketching and creation, which often took place over a very few days. And this was also described by Christian Dior in his autobiography and by Yves Saint Laurent in his own artistic process as well. Here, however, the interviewer also describes Bohan as a very secret and solitary man, serious and playful in turn, but also with the art of keeping his distance. And this is what I want to focus on today, this contrast that this creates with the very flamboyant Patrick Kelly that we've just seen, and then also Christian Lacroix that we're going to talk about next, whose very colourful characters were reflected in their designs. So this is like the kind of contrast between these two very colourful designers, much more retiring. So Bohan was the absolute opposite of these flamboyant rock star kind of designers that were emerging at the time. And this was a period which Christopher Bruard has called, has said that it pretentiously labelled itself the age of the designer. And this highlights a new emphasis on marketing and publicity at this time. And so, because of his very quiet personality, the story of Marc Bohan at Dior is not just the story of the couturier, but of the business directors, whose vitally important role in the direction of the company enabled him the freedom to create. The 1980s encompassed a time of great change at Dior. It was a very turbulent financial period for the company, and it marked this very different transition between the two directors at Dior, the former director Jacques Couette, who had been at Dior since its inception in 1946, and then, of course, Bernard Arnault, who, with the support of the French government, bought Dior's ailing holding group in 1984. So Arnault became the chairman of Dior in 1985, and I'm mainly going to focus on the changes that happened at the house after this period and how Bernard Arnault tried to push Bowen into a much more public-facing role and started to promote him as the artistic director and as the face of the brand. And he was actually promoted to oversee all the design elements, all the design that happened within the house, accessories and all the related products. So when he took over, Arno instigated a comprehensive rebranding strategy, which was disseminated through advertising, promotional campaigns and interviews, as well as through the newly restored Dior boutique, the flagship boutique at the company headquarters in Paris. This period, as I've said, Bowen, really a self-confessed introvert, created a stark contrast with the more flamboyant designers emerging in this era, such as Claude Montana, Thierry Mugler, Gianni Versace, Christian Lacroix, and Karl Lagerfeld. And this new age of the designer was contextualized in this special report by Vogue called What's in a Name, which described how during the 80s, designers became enormously powerful opinion leaders and tastemakers. And in this article, Vogue described how these new designers are building vertical empires from conception to distribution. And they ask, what common denominator, besides talent, got them where they are today? What makes a name survive as an institution whose mention remains magic after the person bearing the name is long dead? These designers have become international celebrities. But the article also asks, how is it that designers who remain relatively unknown are also doing so well? And you can see from the description on this page, on the right-hand image, the answer is the wealth of the tradition, the heritage, and the history of the various luxury houses, which, as Vogue said, continues to nourish designers and help make them special in American eyes. So really, it's this idea of couture being an industry for export, aimed at the American audience and customer. And Vogue notes that though they have taken on the power of financial magnates, designers still live like rock stars for their performances and for their fashion shows, which are these huge, spectacular events during the 80s. And you can see on this page on the right-hand side an example from Chanel and Dior, where notably the couturiers are pictured with their business partners, so Alan Wertheimer and Bernard Arnault, respectively. And the subheading for Dior reads, the Dior name is continually linked to creative luxury. It survives with a worldwide fashion identity 29 years after Dior's death. And Chanel is also described as a legendary name in fashion and fragrances, but at this period it was making its own, it had no licensing contracts, so it was actually producing its own accessories. And of course, you can see as well the example of Pierre Cardin. And here he is described as the creator of the world's greatest fashion empire with over 500 licenses. Now, perhaps, of course, we look at Pierre Cardin more usually, he's considered as this a warning for over-licensing for luxury brands and the consequent dilution of the image of a brand through this over-licensing. So after becoming the chairman of Dior in 1985, Bernard Arnault promoted his plans for the brand, as well as his restructuring strategies through media interviews. First, he created financial stability within the company, and then he streamlined the design and production by introducing a more vertically integrated system. So he regained control of the manufacturing and production, and also of the licensing, where it was produced and who was producing the licensed products. But most importantly, he also made this decision to centralize the design of the brand. And so he made Marc Bowen responsible for all creation within the house. So he became really an artistic director overseeing all the departments of the house. And this was a strategy that was designed to re-establish Dior's name internationally, promoting the Dior business model, alongside this visual legacy and the heritage of the house. And Arnault also emphasized that the success of an institution such as Dior hangs on how well the products are controlled regarding creativity and quality. And in the article in Vogue that I just showed you, Vogue revealed that from the couturier who designed two collections a year when the house was young, when he was just designing two couture collections, Mark Bowen has become the responsible person for several studios that oversee the design of all Dior-named products. And how much the styling can actually affect a vastly known name product was apparent when Mark Bowen personally resumed responsibility for Dior's ready-to-wear line as well. And last season, according to Vogue, the sales to the stores increased by around 50% over the preceding collection. So it really showed how this centralising of the design actually helped the profits of the company. And Vogue said that the personal and private style of the couturier must be reflected in all the creations. Decorations, the windows, the advertising campaigns, the design ateliers abroad as well. There was a Dior New York department as well. And it is therefore, Mark Bowen said, it's therefore essential to have effective teams who feel your style, who understand your projects and your orientations. And there must be a unity of creation, a unity of image in all domains. And Mark Bowen talks about why it was for this purpose that I took over the ready-to-wear, which he'd actually abandoned in 1981. And today, the Haute Couture Studio and the ready-to-wear work in parallel. So you can see how the advertising campaigns and the promotional campaigns were considered overall as one big campaign for the brand. And through interviews, Arnaud revealed that he aimed to re-establish the prominent position which Dior had previously held within the national consciousness. So he reinforced the contribution that Dior made to the haute couture industry and to the fashion industry generally, as well as to the image of France abroad. So as well as the strategy which promoted Bowen to the overall artistic director of the design departments, Arnaud also revealed in Women's Wear Daily that Dior will launch in March a $2.5 million print advertising campaign aimed at updating its image while maintaining this sense of tradition in order to try to make the Dior image unique. And you can see some examples here by Dominique Eastman. She was chosen to do the campaigns for Dior. So this large brand image campaign was set up, and the photographs that you can see here by Dominique Eastman promoted Mark Bowen as the creative force behind the house. And for the first time, he was actually pictured in the advertising. He was really very much a background figure beforehand. And Dominique Eastman had actually created campaigns for other designers such as Sonia Rykiel in the 80s. And she was asked to conceive this visual identity, which was specific to all the lines. So it was the couture and the ready-to-wear. And I can show you a few examples of how similar these two campaigns are. So they're really created as the same campaign. So this advertising and other promotional material demonstrates how Mark Bowen began to be promoted as the face of the brand. And the designer is really pushed to the forefront and almost elevated to the status of an artist. He's like a genius creator, really, both visually and through interviews as well that he made in the press. The campaign from 1986, 1987 signaled this complete change of image for the house, which Arnaud had discussed in his interviews. So as well as appearing in newspapers and magazines, this series of images was also included in press packs that were given out to buyers and clients and stores at various shows. And on the left, you can see this example from the Haute Couture Spring-Summer line from 1986, is the press pack. And here, the image is included inside this card folder, which displays a landscape black and white image by Eastman. And this folds out into this portrait-sized oriented display with a signed quote from Mark Bowen. You can see on the left-hand side in the corner, the model is draped in this toile fabric, and she sits on one of these gold couture chairs that you see at the couture shows. And also, Bowen is pictured dressed in this immaculately tailored dark suit. And he leans against the stone wall with a pen in his hand and a sketch behind him on the wall. Ette is talking about the summer. And also on the right, you can see the model underneath the exotic plant, some of the spring-summer haute couture collection. This white suit, again, immaculately accessorized with gloves and shoes and hats, this complete look.
But here you can see very obviously that Bowen is presented as the face of the brand. His signature and his inspirational quote legitimizing his position as artistic director and almost elevating him to the status of the artist creator. And you can see how it's this new brand myth for Dior. It's very successfully executed through this new aesthetic. And image, you can see a full page from the broadsheet newspaper, an advertisement for the winter 86-87 ready-to-wear boutique collection. And here you can see Mark Bowen dressed in the couturier's white coat, which is a further signifier of the craftsmanship of the house. Again, he's wearing this immaculate dark suit underneath. And you can see on the left hand, on his right, these naked models, almost like muses. It's this very artistic kind of expression in these poses reminiscent of classical art, together with hat boxes and artistically strewn ribbons. And to the right, three models posing in a more typical fashion editorial style, clothed in the winter collection, accessorized again with the hats and gloves, so it's a complete look from Dior. And beneath the house typeface reading the Christian Dior Boutique, which is the ready-to-wear range for Christian Dior, the photographic image is surrounded by this blank space, and towards the bottom of the page, again, the designer has hand-signed his creations for the house. These images, you can see that the House of Dior is promoting Bowen as the face of the brand, elevating him to the status of an artist and legitimizing his creations for the House of the Dior through this gestural act of the artist's signature. So you can see how these promotional images are presented or endowed with this very transformative and symbolic power of the designer's signature, which Bourdieu talked about, which stamps the designs with the authority of the original hand of the designer. It enhances the audience's connection to the designer as well. You can see, obviously, he's given a very public face as the designer of the couture and of the ready-to-wear lines at Dior, and he's almost been pushed into the spotlight, into this much more public-facing role. You can see also further images released for the 40th anniversary of Dior in 1987. These four Stockman stands covered with these simple cotton bibs, which read Dior, together with a naked model draped across the four chairs, again, the gold couture chairs. And the iconic shape of the stands suggests that they could be the original stands from Dior, which, according to legend, were fashioned by Christian Dior himself. If you read about the story on the website, he talks about how he created these particular shapes, which were very revolutionary at the time after the Second World War for his first collection in 1947. This, in its visual aspect, creates a direct link with the founder of the house, Christian Dior. And these very significant objects are used to elevate the brand into a higher aesthetic level in order to re-establish Dior's promotion at the pinnacle of the couture industry. These kinds of images, the association with the licensed products, which obviously were keeping the brand afloat at this time, the makeup and the perfume and the stockings and accessories, which is how they made their money from the brand, all these kind of products are diminished, and the idea of the couture and the craftsmanship are really enhanced through this use of imagery. And this idea of the exclusivity and craftsmanship of the couture range is really emphasized. The branding expert Douglas Holt has identified how iconic brands such as Dior have plots and characters and rely heavily on metaphor to communicate. Often several stories circulate, and a brand emerges when these collective understandings become firmly established. So to win over audiences, they're myths. Iconic brands' communication exude this kind of charisma. So it's just like the idea of a successful political leader. Iconic brands compel audiences to enter their worldview by adopting a distinctive and very compelling aesthetic style that's very well illustrated in these images. So the visual rhetoric of the brand and its repositioning as a prominent luxury French couture house and a luxury brand reinforced not just the craftsmanship and the status of Dior through these images, but the whole couture industry as an industry for export. So the heritage of the brand also began to be reflected in the design elements of the various collections designed by Bowen. See Bowen's interpretation of the classic bar suit, which was included in the boutique, the ready-to-wear press pack. This is an image, and then the back of the press pack as well, with all the information for when it was to be reproduced. And you can see these press cuttings. It made it very easy for the press to... It was a very obvious connection between the heritage of the Dior and the present-day design elements. So this was the boutique collection shown in 1986, and it acted as a precursor to the 40th anniversary celebrations of the house planned for 1987. Another example, because it's very obvious when you look at the design of Mark Bowen that he had not previously been influenced by the iconic Dior silhouette, which you see now designers reinterpret constantly. All the designers like Ferré, Raf Simons, Galliano, they've all been influenced by this iconic Dior design, but Mark Bowen did not have that element within his own design. But here for this collection, you can see that he actually is starting to use the first collection from Dior, the Carole silhouette, as an inspiration for his designs. This is an image from Life magazine in the top left-hand corner from 1947 of the first collection, which was used to illustrate this to En Huit and then the Carole line, which became known as the new look. And on the right-hand side, this is an image from L'Officiel magazine, and you can see Mark Bowen in the studio working on this dress, a kind of press promotional photograph. So you can see from this press coverage how Bowen created this incredibly classic, saleable couture. It's very opposite from this kind of what we've seen with Patrick Kelly, which is very much what people think of as the 80s. This is very classic. He had this very kind of loyal client following. And so rather than creating a sensation with each collection, he was just evolving from season to season, creating this very saleable couture. So here you can see Bowen talking about the collection, saying everything is underplayed. There's very strong, clean shapes. Even the accessories are very plain and simple. I'm just going to finish up with a couple of images. I'm going to talk briefly about the celebrations for the 40th anniversary of Dior, which began in March 1987. Dior, according to L'Officiel, held an unforgettable royal evening, and this was for the gala opening of the new boutique on Avenue Montaigne, you can see in this image, which L'Officiel also described in very glowing terms as the apotheosis of the house. And this image, you can see the preparations for the event. Bernard Arnault, you can see very small here, unfortunately, but he's pictured here in front of the Dior building with Mark Bowen, and you can see the entire staff of the ateliers at Dior, the office staff as well, all wearing the white coats on the balconies behind and leaning out of the windows as well. So again, even you look at the facade of the building as part of this kind of iconic branding of Dior, even the fabric of the building, which had been really newly revamped for this anniversary, you can see the roundels, the grey and white, these iconic Dior colours, even the wrought iron balconies became part of this kind of branding and codes of the house. And then, of course, the most obvious element that you can see are these huge giant lily of the valley on the front of the facade, which actually lit up at night. And so it was like this huge gala event which happened to promote the house, where they invited all the licensees. There are around 300 licensees for Dior, all the customers from America, couture customers, celebrities, royalty, politicians. It was this huge promotional event for the anniversary of the house. It was almost like a Hollywood film premiere where they had spotlights lighting up the sky. And also you can see this use of the Lily of the Valley, which is one of the kind of codes of Dior as well, which was included in the press pack. So it's constantly being reinforced, this idea of the heritage of the house. This theme of the Lily of the Valley was used throughout the gala evening, all the china, which was designed for the evening, had a lily of the valley on it, and then it was available for sale in the boutique afterwards as well. You could go to the boutique and buy it for your own house as well. They had these hundreds of flowers, which they'd grown specially, and that were flown in especially for this gala evening. So I think that these are all by now very familiar tropes at the House of Dior, if you know about the kind of iconic coding within the house. But this is really the first example of using the history and heritage of the house is 1987, when they really, as Le Ficiel said, the apotheosis of this house. This is like, this is the new Dior. This is how we're stamping the branding onto the house. But also, this image, I think, is very interesting because it shows all the workers in their white coats. So it's really emphasizing, again, the craftsmanship of the workrooms. All this very particular, it's very particular to Paris, obviously, this couture workmanship. And again, Dior is disassociating itself from the more licensed products and encouraging this idea of craftsmanship and couture. And then finally, I'm just going to show this image from the exhibition, which was also set up in 1987, started in March 1987, the Hommage à Christian Dior. And this was, according to the press, a grand retrospective of the work of Christian Dior, where all of Paris discovered a genius, a true fashion visionary. And again, it's like the recent exhibition that's been shown in Paris, it's obviously this idea of not exactly rebranding, but reinforcing the heritage of the house. And this exhibition, which was made in collaboration with the House of Dior very strongly, this is when they first discovered their archive. They found it in boxes in the basement of the house, and they started showing again the sketches and the this kind of ephemeral heritage of the house. And it was reinforced through this exhibition, and then obviously through including examples of the 10 years when Christian Dior was at the house. And so this is very much about the rebranding, the re-establishing of Dior at the pinnacle of the couture industry. And it almost consolidated this visual vocabulary for the brand for this new era of 1980s couture, which you've seen since has been continually reinforced by the house. So I think actually my 20 minutes are up, so I'm going to finish there. Thank you very much.
I think it's October. October 1986.
I just have a look from my. Yes, October 1986. It's American Vogue. Yeah, and it's got a lot of prominent designers in Europe. It's a really interesting article.
Des questions?
One first question. Many of us weren't aware there was this early exhibition on Dior at Les Arts Décoratifs. Who was the curator, you remember?
Florence
Muller?
No, it wasn't. It was
Yvonne Delon?
Les Arts Décoratifs, but it was a different name at that point. I've forgotten because I haven't got in the notes. But yes, that's what it was then. Before it became Les Arts Décoratifs. A very well-respected historian that I can't remember because I don't have it in my footnotes here. But
What did Bohan think about being pushed to the spotlight like this?
Well, there isn't any. He doesn't make any kind of comment about it, but it seems when you look at the interviews that it seems fairly obvious that he has. I mean, I guess you would call it now this media training where he is talking about this kind of, he's kind of trying to talk about what the house wants to transmit, the kind of message that the house wants to transmit. So he is very much, as they would say nowadays in modern parlance, on message when he talks about his collections, and he's talking about how exciting it is to have a new injection of energy at the house because there have been so many years of problems since about 1978, financial problems at the house, and then with problems with the previous director. And he was just saying, it's really great to have a new, young, energetic director. But a lot of the press was actually very much about Bernard Arnault rather than Marc Bowen, which I think is quite interesting. So he was really became the spokesperson rather than Marc Bowen. So, and then obviously Bernard Arnault got rid of him 2 years later and got a new designer in. So it was.
Towards a placing Ogbudu as a marketing tool.
Yes.
And afterwards, being ready to wear as the fashion tool sell. I'm not sure if I understood correctly, so that transition was during Baum's period.
I mean, he had been designing some of the ready-to-wear during the 1970s, and then he stopped in 1981. But then after Marc Bowen, after Bernard Arnault took over as the chairman, then Marc Bowen was required again to design the ready-to-wear, or at least oversee the design of the ready-to-wear. He had teams of people working on that. So it was obviously had to be strongly influenced by the couture. So there was this amalgamation of the design element. So it was one vision. That was the way that they wanted to promote it, as one vision. But the ready-to-wear range had been going on since 1947, since the first collection they started breaking into ready-to-wear at that early period. And then they also had the Christian Dior New York, which produced its own, and then a house in London and various other countries as well. So it was a huge enterprise.
So they also used this situation to centralize and to put a general collection of ready-to-wear instead of each country making their own.
Yes, I mean, the countries had always been influenced and had to design from the couture collection. That was the way that it worked. But what they made a conscious effort to do was centralise the design and to show that all these decisions were coming from Paris. So it was very much this director was designing from Paris.
More hands-on.
Yes, I guess he wasn't necessarily doing much more work. I think that it was made to seem as if he was, perhaps. I don't know exactly how much he actually had to do, but he had teams of people working on the ready-to-wear, so he oversaw it. I mean, in the way that you would see, like Raf Simons was working, right? You know, he's overseeing other collections.
Do you have access to the Dior?
No.
I was wondering about the term in management. If you have observed also a term in the management of the house, I mean for this
in the mid 80s,
this switch from licenses to direct design and.
Yes, there was. I mean, that was the reason that they changed. I think because they changed managers, so. No, they changed. The manager then started to make it much more controlled from Paris and centralised it, vertical integration, so controlling the licences. So they reduced the number of licensees that were allowed because it was so kind of widely spread. Basically, Dior was making its money from licensing during the 80s. Yeah, absolutely. So they that didn't necessarily change, but they actually just tried to control it more.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.